All right, so welcome back, and we are on Parakeet Zion, Chapter 17. Last week we gave a review briefly, or not so briefly as it may be, of Chapter 16, and then started on the outline for Parakeet Zion for Chapter 17 and asked a key question, which we're going to come back to today, of how long elapsed between Chapter 16 and Chapter 17. Was that something that was just the hang on 1 second, actually. Here we go. Okay. I had to change something on mine. So was it something that the events of Chapter 16, in which David is anointed as king and Shaul starts to deteriorate, is immediately before Chapter 17 and the Plishti, the Philistine attack? Or the other way to look at it was to suggest that actually some period of time has elapsed. And we noted that the Malbim is really the only one to speak to this explicitly. And he says that that Chapter 17 follows shortly after Chapter 16. It's a recent thing, Chapter 16. And that's going to be something that we're going to, as I said, come back to today, and we'll see the effects of that. But first, let's take a look at Psukim Aleph to Gimel, sentences 1 to 3. Everyone got the source sheet, I hope? Everyone has that? Great. Okay. For anyone who is not on the email list or did not get the source sheet, do me a favor, please, just send me an email afterwards and let me know. And that way I'll be able to make sure that everybody is getting it. And I'm putting my email address in the chat so that those who don't have the email, the email will be able to email me. There we go. Okay. So let's take a look at at the beginning of the chapter. The Plishtim gathered their camp for war. They were gathered to Socho, which is part of the land of Yehuda of Judea. We said last time it's in the middle, in terms of east to west. It's in the middle of the country. And they camped between Socho and a place called Azeka, in a place called Efes Damim. And we noted last time from Rav Bazak that the Plishtim are not venturing out as far as they did in the previous battle, where they went all the way to Michmas, and that perhaps signifies again that not much time has elapsed since the last chapter and since their defeat at the hands of Shaul and Yonatan, and that's why they don't venture out as far. So the Plishtim have gathered to this place, and Pasuk Bet, sentence 2, V'Shaul v'Ish Yisrael ne'esfu. Shaul and the Jews have gathered. V'achanu be'emek ha'ela, and they camp in a place called Emek Ha'ela, which we're going to have to talk about. V'yarchu milchama l'kras Plishtim, and they set up to go up against the Plishtim. Note, as we said last time, by the way, I didn't mention it this time, this is the fourth battle between the Plishtim and the Jews in this book alone, which is really, really remarkable. So this battle takes place at Emek Ha'ela, the Jews camp at Emek Ha'ela, they set up for war, Ufilishtim omdim el ha'har mizeh, v'Yisrael omdim el ha'har mizeh, and the Plishtim are on one mountain and the Jews are on another mountain, v'hagai b'nehem, with a valley between. So, a few things. First of all, Emek Ha'ela is in central Israel. It's a little bit south. It's west of Yerushalayim, south of Beit Shemesh. What is with this place, Efes Damim? So here, I want to get into a little bit of a side note, just to show you a complication in Tanakh. It's not going to really lead anywhere in particular in terms of understanding this chapter, but it's a very interesting problem. If you take a look on your sheets, source number one, you see that I brought you material from Divrei Hayamim, from Chronicles. Everyone has that? Okay. Ve'ele mispar ha'giborim asher li'David. This is, as you see, the translation there is from the current Jerusalem Bible. I didn't do my own translation this time for it, just no time. So thank you to Sfired.org, who presents it on their site. This is the number of the mighty men whom David had. And we list Yashavam is one of them. And boy, was he powerful. He raised his lance against 300 300 men who he killed, and over 300 shlosh mil chalal, 300 men who he killed. And then there's another one named Elazar ben Dodo ha'achochi. He is among the three mighty warriors of David. And Pasuk Gimel, sentence 13, I bolded it in the Hebrew, Hu haya im David bapas damim. He was with David at Pas Damim. Vaplishtim ne'esfusham la'milchama. The Philistines gathered there for war. The field was filled with barley, and the Jews fled from the Plishtim, and these warriors defeated the Plishtim after the Jews had fled. So I have a war with the Plishtim in Efes Damim in our story, and in Divrei Hayamim Chronicles, which is telling us things about the time when David was king, I am told that there was a war with the Plishtim in a place called Pas Damim. So the Talmud Yerushalmi actually links the two events and links them with a third incident, which is in source number 2. I'm not going to go into source number 2 much. It's in Shmuel Bet, chapter 23, so we'll get there one of these decades. But the reason that they connect it to that story is because the warriors who are mentioned in source number 1 in Divrei Hayamim are also mentioned in source number 2 in Shmuel Bet. So you see, I bolded for you in the Hebrew, Elazar ben Dodo is listed in both places. And the Gemara goes on to deal with the problem of the fact that in one case it says the field had barley in it, in the other case it says the field had lentils in it, but we're not going there. Right now, the conflicts or non-conflicts between Divrei Hayamim and Shmuel will have to be something we deal with, God willing, in Shmuel Bet chapter 23. But what I wanted to show you is the definition of Efes Damim or Pas Damim. And that's in source number 3. You know, I pinned my video so that I would be the main one on the screen for when this is up on YouTube so that people wouldn't all be so visible, but I can't see everybody and it's hard for me to give a share that way. So I'm going back to having the gallery view. If you take a look at source number 3, the Yerushalmi says, quoting Divrei Hayamim, Hu hayaim David be'efes damim. Elazar ben Dodo was with David in this place called Efes Damim, which is actually Pas Damim in Divrei Hayamim. It's Efes Damim with us. Rabbi Yochanan Amar b'chakal sumakta. Rabbi Yochanan says it was in the red field. Now, what I think the Yerushalmi there is doing is connecting it with the idea that it was chamlea adashim. There were lentils in Shmuel Bet, and lentils are red. So therefore, Efes Damim or Pas Damim is the red field. Damim, blood, being red. That's the that's one read. Professor Kiel in the Da'at Mikra thinks that it actually means red earth, because he says there is a place called Al-Khamra, which is in Emek Ha'elah, that has red clay. So he thinks that may be what the Yerushalmi means.
Actually, a lot of the soil in Israel is red to this day.
Right. I mean, it's a regional thing. Yeah,
around Tel Aviv, Rehovot. Yeah. I remember the gardens there when they dug them up. It was red.
Mm-hmm.
The earth was red.
Okay. Well, the other explanation that the Yerushalmi brings in source number 3 from Rabbi Shmuel says, Shamisham nifsiku damim. From there, the blood stopped. In the sense that, it seems, the wars with the Plishtim stop. That's his answer. It fits with Efes Damim, Efes meaning zero, there's no blood, or Pas Damim. The term Pas can mean to halt, like Pasu Emunim is a phrase that we find. The only problem with this is that we still had more wars and more wars with the Plishtim after this. So I'm mentioning it now just because it's really interesting to see the connection in these three stories. Here we have, in our discussion, David fighting a war in Efes Damim. And in Divrei Hayamim, we describe him fighting a war with the Plishtim in Pas Damim. And then there's a warrior who's mentioned in the war with Pas Damim in Divrei Hayamim, who's also mentioned in a war in Shmuel Bet. So all these stories get connected. When we get, God willing, to Shmuel Bet, chapter 23, we'll make sense of it. And everyone is going to remember, of course, that we discussed this now, because totally fits that we'll get there, you know, sometime soon. Okay. But the big question that I was curious about in this story, that was a side note, but the big question I'm curious about is, why are they on mountains? Right? Why are they on mountains? First of all, they were in Emek Haila, right? And Emek is a valley. So why'd they go on mountains, number one? And number two, that's not how warriors fight. You don't fight up on the mountains. You retreat to the mountains, right? If you remember from Shoftim, where the Knanim drove the Jews up into the mountains. Why is everybody on the mountains here? So Radak gives you one answer. He says that the representatives of each group ascended the mountains, because we are going to find representatives of each group coming up next. And he says that's what it was. It was only there were certain representatives of each group who ascended the mountains. And then I saw a reference in the Dot Mikra edition to Josephus. Take a look at source number 4 on your sheet. He's telling the story of this battle between David and Goliath. David and Goliath. He says, "Now the Philistines gathered themselves together again. No very long time afterward," he is in agreement with us that not much time has elapsed between chapter 16 and 17. "And having gotten together a great army, they made war against the Israelites. And having seized a place between," they have it as Shocho, or is it Socho, "and Azekah, they there pitched their camp." That's the Philistines. "Saul also drew out his army to oppose them. And by pitching his own camp on a certain hill, he forced the Philistines to leave their former camp and to encamp themselves upon such another hill, over against that on which Saul's army lay, so that a valley which was between the two hills on which they lay divided their camps asunder." So the way that Josephus reads it is that the Jews took the lead. If you look back into the verses, the Plishtim came there first, and then Shaul goes, and he says the Jews actually went up on a mountain, and then the Plishtim, in order to match that, went up on a mountain opposite it. What story does this remind you of?
Can I ask something?
Wait. First, Leona, first answer my question and then ask yours. Okay. What story does this remind you of that we saw earlier in Shmuel?
Oh, in Shmuel. Were
they on a mountain? Oh, with Yonatan going up on the mountain.
Yonatan, bingo. Okay. Right? Yonatan goes to the Plishtim when he launches his sneak attack, and the Plishtim have the high ground. Mm-hmm. The Plishtim want the high ground. And I think that's what's going on here, a la what Josephus is suggesting. The Jews took the high ground, and the Plishtim are not happy to be in the valley below. So therefore, they have to go up on a mountain now as well. I think what he's saying makes sense. Leona, what was your question going to be? Now I owe you.
I'm a little confused in the wording here. It says, "V'Shaul v'Ish Yisrael nesfu v'yachanu be'emek ha'el." It says they actually encamped in the valley. So how did they end up on the mountain?
Right. And the only answer I can give you is that they're on a peak within this general area called Emek Ha'ela. In other words, the Emek is not a description of the whole thing being a lower bowl type of an area. But there are higher points and there are lower points, and the Emek presumably is in between those higher points.
So they'd have to come into the valley to fight.
Yes. I would expect so. Yeah. I would expect so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Susan, you were gonna say? No? So the big question in this is, why now? What's going on that the Plishtim have decided that they need to attack at this point? And I go back again. If it's been a long time since chapter 16, then the answer is what we said last week, which is the Plishtim have recovered from being defeated, and now they're back. However, if it's been a brief time, then I don't understand what's their rush. They were just routed badly. Why in the world would they do that? So the answer will be, as it is in many cases of war in Tanakh, if not 100% of them, this is God's hand bringing this war about with a goal in mind. Take a look, please, at source number 5 on your sheet, where I brought you the Malbim. And this is where he makes his comment that only a little time had elapsed. He says, and I'll read out my English, you can see the original Hebrew here as well. "This informs that when the Spirit of God left the head of their king, meaning our king, Shaul, the might of Israel fell away, and the Philistine enemy, who had just recently fallen before Yonatan alone, now became powerful. Now their hearts strengthened them to battle Israel. Not only that, but immediately upon assembling their camp in the land of the Philistines, they went to the land of Judah and completed their assembly there, as it says, and they gathered to Socho of Yehuda, and they did not fear to assemble in Yehuda. In other words, the opposite of the point that I made before, that they haven't ventured out as far. Yeah, but look at them. They're in Yehuda, as though they had already conquered the land. And immediately after they gathered in Socho, they moved from there to Ephes Damim to draw close to the camp of Israel. There they camped. Malbim says, the absence of Ruach Hashem from Shaul, God is no longer with him, is what does it. I got a message from someone that someone is trying to get back on the class. So that's saying the name aloud, I guess. I'm not blocking them from entering, I think. Oh, wait, there we go. The waiting room disappeared for a moment. Thank you. Thanks very much. Okay, welcome back. So going back to where we were, Malbim says this is a consequence of chapter 16. Because Shaul lost the Ruach Hashem, the Plishtim suddenly stopped feeling afraid of the Jews. Even though David has it, David's not leading their armies. However,
So obviously the Plishtim somehow or another had spies or were close enough to know that there is a problem going on with Shaul and that this is a good time for them to counterattack.
So that's one approach. Leona suggests one way that the Plishtim would be aware of this, and that is because they had spies and they knew Shaul was deteriorating. They're calling a musician for him and so on. Kim Jong-un is in trouble, right, apparently every other month until they take a new picture of him and he's fine. That would be one way that it could be. The other is to read it as supernatural. In other words, when Hashem is with Shaul, there is an aura that intimidates others. It's not something that they can know on a practical level. It's just an influence. And that would be another way to view it. However, once Malbim is suggesting this, I'm going to float another idea, which is, what is the consequence of this war? What's the direct result of this war?
Big.
That David becomes a presence in the Jewish world.
Yeah. It's the elevation of David in the eyes of the nation, right?
He's a hero.
He's a hero, correct. So it's also possible to contend that what motivates this is not necessarily Shaul's deterioration, but Hashem says, I need to bring the Plishtim back. Because this is how David is going to gain his reputation by killing Goliath. That will be another way to read this. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Hi. Last year, I went to a class by Rena Basser, who's a historian, and she brought up two points, that often wars were put on hold because of bad weather, so they would just go back home for a few weeks and continue where they left off, or maybe to get the crops cut or whatever, harvested. The other point she made with having a champion on each side fighting each other was because it made more economic sense to have healthy warriors enslaved. You know, they instead of having 1,000 dead soldiers from the other side, now they had 1,000 healthy slaves to do a lot of the work. So maybe the Plishtim came back because whatever reason the timeout was for, now it was over. Because of maybe the weather got better. And also because with David and Goliath, it was because it made more sense economically to leave a lot of men from the opposite side alive to be slaves.
Right. Thank you. So in terms of your second point, I'm going to leave that until we talk about what his offer was, what Goliath's offer was, and why he would have offered it, because that is one of the possibilities that we're going to have to entertain. But in terms of the first idea, the idea that that there had been some kind of a timeout, if you look back at the previous battle between them, it didn't sound that way at all. Meaning the Plishtim were routed and the Jews pursued them until they had to stop because the Urim Vitumim didn't let them proceed. Okay. So that I wouldn't say. But in terms of the idea of, as you put it, economics, that's something I am planning on coming back to when we talk about Goliath's offer. So that's what's coming next year. Is going to be the next section here, Psukim Dalid to Yud, sentences 4 to 10. And here, we're going to meet Goliath, and we're going to meet his formidable armor. And he's going to make an offer, as Cheryl just indicated. Spare both sides a war. Let's resolve this with a battle between me and your champion, and whichever side has the victor will enslave the other one. So I want to read through the Psukim first and just understand the story and then get out some deeper ideas of what's happening here. So take a look, please, at Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. Vayetze ish habeinayim mimachanos plishtim, Golyas shemo migas. The ish habeinayim left the Philistine camps. His name was Goliath, and he was from Gath. Remember that the plishtim had a Pentapolis, 5 cities. And Gath was one of them. At one point, I think it was even the lead city. And he is from Gath. He is the Ish HaBeinayim. I haven't translated that yet. Govho Shesh Amot Vazaret. You know how tall he was. 6 Amma plus a Zeret. Okay. So let's look at this sentence a little more carefully. First of all, Ish HaBeinayim. That's a very interesting turn of phrase. I don't know what it means. That's what I mean when I say interesting. So what exactly is Ish HaBeinayim? Now, I know different people have different translations in front of them, but since I can't see everybody, I don't know what they have. So Susan, I know you have the pink edition. Don't read from the bottom of the page, please, but just from the translation, what is Ish HaBeinayim translated as?
And the champion emerged.
The champion. Ish HaBeinayim is champion. Okay. Someone who has an art scroll, what does art scroll say for Ish HaBeinayim?
Champion too.
Champion. Okay, they both like the idea that it is champion. Interesting. Champion, does anybody else have a translation that does not say champion in the text? Yes, Leona, what do you have?
We have the man of space between two armies.
The man of space between two armies.
Whatever that means.
You understand where that comes from. Beinayim.
Yeah,
right? Between, in the interval.
Right.
It makes a lot of sense. Does anyone have another translation that says something different from champion or the man of space between the spaceman between the two armies?
I don't know what that means.
Okay, so here's the deal. Rashi, Radak, Ralbag, Abarbanel all say Beinayim is from the word Bein, being in between. And what it means is the man in the middle, between the camps. Professor Keel in the Dot Mikra edition says that this is actually a particular position. It's not just, in this case, Goliath stepped into the middle. It's actually a role in war. And he refers you to something from the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a scroll in the Dead Sea, you know, we're most familiar probably with the Dead Sea Scrolls that mirror books in Tanakh. And have all or part of texts from Tanakh in them. But there's another scroll there called the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness, or the war between the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness. That's among the scrolls. And it records, or not records, predicts, a battle. I'm just going to mute everyone except for myself by default. You can always unmute in order to be able to ask a question or make a comment. But in this scroll, we get a description of an apocalyptic battle with a major focus in this scroll on the kinds of weapons they used and the way the battle is waged. And there they refer to this role. It was actually a position to go out and be the one who would, before the main war, would venture to attack the other side. So that makes sense with the idea that Ish HaBeinayim is going to be Goliath, because that's exactly what he seems to be doing, at least until he makes his offer. And so that's an approach. However, the Gemara in Sota has other views, including some that say this is about his physical stature. Take a look at source number 6. I see you smiling, Susan. I'm not going to say those of the other ones. I'm going to refer to them, but I'm not going to read the other ones aloud. The Gemara in Sota in source number 6, for those who are wondering what I'm talking about, don't worry, we'll get there. But the Gemara there says, "My Beinayim." What is Beinayim? Amar Rav Shemivune Mikol Mum. Rav said he was built up, Mivune, Bone, to build. He was built up without any defect. In other words, this is a guy you have to be afraid of. He's got no weaknesses. He's got no flaws. Shmuel then says, Beinoni Shebe'echav. He was average among his brethren. Beinayim, Beinoni. Hi, you think I'm tall? You should see my older brother, right? That kind of thing. Commentators ask how in the world you could think that he was anything other than a standout. Nonetheless, Rabbi Shila's yeshiva, they taught another lesson, also building on Beinayim, Shu'asui Kibinyan. He was built like a building, this guy Goliath. So it's about his physical stature. I'm going to come back later to other views that the Gemara presents. I'm not done with this Gemara. But the general view is, this is a description of a very intimidating warrior. How intimidating is he? Well, he's 6 amah plus a zeret. So 6 amah we know. An amah is six.
How much is an amah?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. An amah is 6 tefach. Okay. A tefach, Susan, you can't hear? Can everybody else hear?
We're kept cutting in and out.
Okay, hopefully you can hear
now. I didn't get the important stuff, but now you're saying it again.
Okay, again, an amah is 6 tefach. A tefach, according to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, is 3.6 inches. The distance of a tefach is if you take your fist and you measure from here to here, that's a tefach. So Rabbi Feinstein says that a tefach is supposed to be 3.6 inches. There are others who say it's longer than that, but that was the figure that he gave. Working with his lowball number, multiplying that out, that means that an amah, right, multiply 6 times 3.6, we can do that, is 21.6 inches. Multiply that by 6, and you're at 129.6 inches. In other words, almost 13 feet. You can put that in other numbers for the metric system, but I didn't grow up with a metric system. I apologize. But basically, what you're talking about is somebody who is more than 3 meters tall. That's what we're saying. But what's a zeret? So zeret is a weird number, is a weird figure to be using here. At least I think so, anyway. A zeret it comes up in Shmot, specifically when we're describing the utensils that are built, that are equipment that is created for the Mishkan. So certain things are measured as being a zeret wide or a zeret long. And the zeret is usually rendered as the breadth between your outstretched thumb and your pinky. In other words, if you go like this, if you spread your fingers from here to here, is a zeret.
I thought the zeret was a pinky.
So, thank you. The Gemara in Ksuvos says that we name each finger based on the role that it plays in halacha, in Jewish law, and the pinky's name is the zeret because it's used for this measure. That's exactly the point. So this is a zeret. So he's 6 amah, but he's not just 6 amah. He's 6 amah and a zeret. I really find that odd, just because, like, if he's 6 amah, you don't need to throw in the extra zeret, right? Like a kid, when he's 3, insists that, you know, I'm not just 3, I'm 3 and 6 weeks. I'm 3 and a month, right? When you're 70, you don't really say that anymore. Most people, I think. If he's 6 meters tall, did you need to throw in the extra 3 inches? why was that an issue? Nonetheless, there's an article in the journal Truman in volume 9 of the journal Truman that discusses this more. I just want to see if I missed anybody else who was trying to come in when I couldn't see the chat. But I don't see. Okay, good. All right. So I don't know what to do with the zeret, but this guy is way tall. However, it's not just that he's tall. go back into the sentences and look at Pasuk Hey, the next sentence, sentence 5. Bechova nechoshes al rosho. Okay. He had a hat of nechoshet. Nechoshet, copper, brass, bronze, right? Technically, we say it's copper, but copper doesn't appear in nature unless it's alloyed with something else to make brass or bronze. It's either alloyed with tin or nickel. So he has this helmet on his head. Vishiryon kaskasim hulavush. And he also has shiryon. Shiryon, you know, right? What is shiryon in the Israeli army today? It's armor.
The tank.
Yeah, it's the armored division. Shiryon is armor, and the design of the armor is with scales, meaning that what they used to do, and Professor Keel brings this in the Dot Mikra, is they would have a leather garment, so it's flexible, and then they would layer pieces of metal over it, like scales, so that the pieces themselves are small. It's not like a big unit, and therefore you have some flexibility, but you also have overlapping protection. So that's what he is wearing. And how much does it weigh? Chameshes alafim shkalim nechoshes. 5,000 shekel. So there are some in the commentators who think that there are actually different shkalim associated with different types of metal, and this is 5,000 copper shekel. As opposed to, later we're going to see, shkalim barzel, iron shekel. However, I don't think that's the general consensus. But rather, it's saying 5,000 shkalim of copper. What is exactly the weight of 5,000 shkalim? So Professor Keel to the rescue once again. He says, based on archaeological finds, the shekel back then would have been about 12 grams. Multiply that out by 5,000. About 60 kilo. I mean, look, when you're six amma tall, you're 13 feet tall, what's another 60 kilo to be carrying? Your knees are already pretty strong, I would hope. Susan.
On his head, the 60 kilo?
No. This isn't the helmet. This is the armor.
Yeah. I want to know for Kashkashim. My translation, in the bottom it says the scales, but the English up here says a coat of mail, M-A-I-L. Yeah. And I don't know what that means.
Armor. But that's armor. That's the overlapping armor that they're describing. It's just a technical
word. So mail has another meaning.
No, mail, M-A-I-L, is a term for this kind of overlapping armor.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the reason why they add the word scales is because when you look in the Torah in Parshas Shmini and it describes fish, kosher fish, and they have to have fins and scales, so the word for scales is kaskeset. Yeah, same as here. Okay.
How did he move?
And the answer is he's really big, and therefore 60 kilo just doesn't bother him. Keep on reading. Umitzchas nechoshes al raglav. He had a copper plate on his legs. Mitzchas, like the word metzach, which is the forehead, it's a flat plate that they would also wear, I guess, on their knees or on their shins. It's some kind of knee pad. V'chidon nechoshes bein kseifav. And then a kidon of copper between his shoulders. Now, this also is subject to some debate because the word kidon is a lance. It's an offensive weapon. What is it doing between his shoulders? So Rashi says that this was shaped like a lance, but it wasn't a weapon. It was actually armor for the back of his neck. It was a post that emerged from the helmet and extended downward. Ralbag thinks it's a plate of some kind. However, Radak and Abarbanel think, no, this was also a weapon. And the idea is either it was suspended between his shoulders, right? You think of like a knight with like a sword back there, right? That he's going to pull out, something like that. It's either suspended between his shoulders or it's lying across his shoulders, but it's because his hands are full with the other weapons. So this is an extra weapon for him to draw that's either vertical or horizontal at shoulder height. But he's not done. V'chetz chaniso kimenor or gim. In addition to that, he has a chanit, which is also some kind of a lance, a spear. It's actually going to show up later in Shmuel. We'll have other incidents with a chanit. And the chetz of it, when it says chetz here, think eights would. It's the pole of it, or the handle of it, was kiminor or gim. So it was like the beam that weavers would use when they set up the loom. Vilaheves chaniso, and the blade of this spear, sheish me'os shkalim barzel, 600 shekel of iron, 600 shekel, Professor Keel to the rescue, 7 to 8 kilo is this spear. V'nosei hatzina holech lefanav. And there was a shield bearer who walked in front of him. He carries the shield because at this point, what else is he going to do? First of all, he's got, his hands are pretty full. But second, he's so weighed down. So he needs somebody in front of him to carry the shield. I have to admit, I'm a little bit perplexed by that because I don't understand how he functions in battle. Like, what exactly does this guy do? Presumably, this guy's regular height. Like, what good is he to defend Goliath? I'm not really clear on how that works. Yes, Claudette.
He's there to intimidate.
The shield bearer?
No, not the guy. I think all of those armor and the bearer and all that is intimidate the other army.
Oh, look, I'm intimidated. I think mission accomplished. I just don't understand what this shield bearer is doing. And I don't know unless he's carrying the shield in order to hand it to Goliath at some point. And I don't know where he is in this story. Meaning it's not like in the end, David is going to kill Goliath and then someone's going to come along and fire the shield bearer. Or like the shield bearer, like I don't really understand what he's doing here, but he's there.
He was like a standard bearer, like,
No flags, he's a shield bearer. It's a shield.
But there would be a coat of arms on the shield.
Oh, so you think it's that kind of, it's ornamental?
Like it's like an announcement, like look who's coming.
Yeah, is it like
I think I can already see who's coming.
Like a status symbol?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, the word Sina shows up elsewhere in Tanakh, and it's just, it's a big shield. I don't know. So let's see what happens now. You have this big, big guy with all these weapons and all this armor. Vayamod vayikra marchos Yisrael. He stands and he calls out to the Jewish camps. Vayomer lem, and he says to them, why do you need to come out and wage war? And this goes back to Cheryl's suggestion from before. Hello, Anochi Aplishti. Look, I'm the Philistine. Ve'atem avadim l'Shaul, and you are slaves of Shaul. Brulachem ish, v'yered Eli. Choose somebody. Choose a champion, and let him come fight me. Im yuchali hilachem iti v'ikani. If he's able to beat me, then we all become your slaves. And if I defeat him, then you become our slaves and you serve us. And the Plishti says, I really gave it to them. I have humiliated the camps of Israel on this day. I said, give me a man. And we'll fight. Ha, they can't put anybody up. And Shaul and all Israel hear this. And boy, are they scared. Okay.
Why would they refer to Bnei Israel? I mean, I think it's good psychological warfare to call the army slaves of Shaul, because it would soften the blow of being, if they're slaves, what difference does it make who they're slaves to? Shaul or the Philistines? Was it kind of to a psychological thing?
So like, that's one question we have to ask here, is why does Goliath choose to frame it as slaves of Shaul, especially when it's not parallel? He doesn't say we are slaves of whoever the king of the Plishtim is. Later on, the king of the Plishtim will be Achish. We're familiar with another name, Avimelech, but right now I don't know who their king is. But he doesn't. There's no balance to it. He seems to be doing something. Maybe it's psychological warfare, like Cheryl suggests. That's one question. Don't try to answer that one yet. We're going to come back to it. But I have, what other questions do we have? Yes.
The Hapsishti. Hapsishti. Like, I am the, as opposed, like, I am
right.
The
old.
Like,
he didn't say, I am a Philistine. Ani plishti. He said, I am the plishti. I am the Philistine. And make no mistake about it, they can hear that capital hey for miles away. What is that about also? Yes, Leona.
I'm just kind of curious why they would do this, simply because if they already sense the weakness of Shaul and so they took it upon themselves to attack and thought that they would be ready, why do they just put this man there in the front rather than the whole army going to attack? Like, what was the purpose of this?
Well, you could make the argument that it is indeed economics. In other words, we don't need to actually follow through. We're just going to stick this guy up there. He'll beat them. And then we can go home. It's
so
entirely
the armies possible. Were all gathered. All he had to do was send a messenger to Shaul and say, I have this great warrior. If you can match this warrior, we can avoid war. We don't have to mass our troops on one mountain and on the other or in the valley. Like, it just,
well, then what happens? Realistically, what would happen if the Jews received a message like that? What would happen next?
The same thing as now.
Really?
And maybe Shaul would not have seen Goliath and
Goliath. Shaul would tell him, go home.
Somebody.
Shaul would tell him to go home. He wouldn't. The idea is that you have your military arrayed there, and here's your choice. Rock in a hard place, right? Either Goliath, or we can go to war with you. Take your pick. But I have another question. Jump to the end of the chapter, please. Sentence 51. Pasuk Nun Aleph. After Goliath is already dead.
Okay.
Pasuk Nun Aleph. Vayarotz David vayamod el haplishti. After he's knocked down Goliath. So David runs forward, stands over the Philistine, Goliath. Vayikach es charbo. And he takes his sword. He doesn't have a sword. Vayishlafa mitara, pulls it out of the scabbard, vayamosisehu, and he kills Goliath. Vayichros ba'as rosho, he cuts off his head. Vayiru haplishtim kimez giboram vayanusu, and the plishtim see this, and they run away. And then look what happens. Vayakumu anshei Yisrael v'Yehuda, and all of the Jews rise up. Vayariu, they trumpet, vayudifu es haplishtim, and they chase the plishtim ad boacha, guy, till you come to the valley, vayad sharei Ekron, to the gates of Ekron, one of the plishti cities. Vayiplu chalalei plishtim bederech sha'arayim, vayad gat, vayad Ekron, and the plishtim are falling the whole way through. What happened to the deal? I thought the deal is whoever wins, the other side are avadim. That's not the way it played out.
They're running. They're fleeing.
So this is hard to understand. What exactly is this about? So Abarbanel brings a view that he hates. He says, this is absolutely wrong. But he says, I heard about this view from people I'm close to who told me that the Christians believe it. That's what he writes. The view is that this was a duel. It was considered to be a more civilized way to deal with conflict, sparing lives. So Abarbanel says that's what they think this was. The Goliath is challenging any Jew to a duel. And Abarbanel says this makes no sense. First of all, he quotes, it's very interesting. Remember when Abarbanel lives, end of the 15th century into the very beginning of the 16th century. Apparently duels were already controversial by his day. So he brings a little bit of the social debate as to whether a duel is the appropriate way to deal with things. Is it really moral? But then he says, I have all sorts of reasons to think that this was not a duel. He says, number one, a duel is not a way to achieve justice. If someone has been wronged, if someone has been harmed, challenging to a duel is not going to provide any sort of remuneration. It isn't going to provide any sort of compensation for what's been done. That's number one. From a moral perspective, he says a duel doesn't cut it. Number two, he says the way a duel works is, as you know, as someone who lives in 21st century Canada, I'm not really so familiar. But he says the way a duel works is if there's a dispute between parties and there's no way to gain satisfaction via the courts, then you do a duel in order to make God the arbiter. In other words, the idea is not whoever is the better fighter is going to win. The idea is whoever God favors is going to win. If you think of trial by ordeal, right? The idea that sometimes they used to, this was not a Jewish thing, but you would try somebody by throwing them in the water or putting them in a fire and say, well, if they're really innocent, God will save them. Sorry, Leona, what?
What about sota?
Sota's the opposite of trial by ordeal.
Yeah.
It's the exact opposite. In trial by ordeal, the natural result is their death. They require a miracle to save them. Okay. In sota, you drink water with a little bit of dust from the base of Mikdash, and nothing's going to happen to you.
But it sounded like it was the same.
That's why I jumped when you said it, because it's the opposite of trial by ordeal. People do say it, but it's not so. There's more to be said about that, but it's not for right now. But Abarbanel says, if the point of doing this is supposed to be there's a dispute between parties and you're doing this as your means of trial, let's see who God decides is right. He said, there was no dispute here. No dispute. There's nothing in doubt. They didn't say to the Jews, you stole our sheep. Like what dispute are you trying to resolve? Further, he says, I know the way duels are supposed to be done. And by the way, I bullet pointed all of this in source number 7. I thought about bringing you the whole of Abarbanel, but decided it's just overkill. A duel needs to have a written, formal set of agreed upon rules. You know, I'm going to step 30 paces. You'll step 30 paces. We'll turn around and fire our pistols. Whatever it is, you need a set of rules. There are no rules here. It requires participants who have equal standing and equal equipment. Because the whole point, again, is that God is the one who's determining who is right. So they each have to be the same. You'll need referees in order to ensure that it's done fairly. And finally, he says, as I pointed out, look at what happened at the end. They didn't honor the deal. He says, it can't be a duel. Abarbanel says, no way.
It is a duel in the sense duel coming from duo to two people alone fighting. Yeah, all the medieval times when the duel had all kinds of prescribed rules and regulations. But if you just look at the word duel by itself, it means basically a fight between two people.
Right. So the truth of the matter is that duel, not as a technical term, is what Abarbanel thinks it is. Abarbanel believes that what's happening at this stage is simply Goliath boasting, I'm a really big guy. Let's see any Jew who can come out against me, and I'll fight him one-on-one. That's the way Abarbanel reads it. But Malbim says no. Malbim says it absolutely was a duel. A formal one. The dispute was that the Plishtim wanted to go back to ruling us the way they had before, and we weren't interested. That's the dispute, so to speak, this is meant to resolve. But then where are the rules and this equal standing and all that? Malbim says David rejected it. As we'll see in the dialogue, David says, I'm not interested in having any kind of duel. I am coming after you in the name of God. And therefore, they don't honor the deal that that Goliath was trying to set up here. Follow? I thought that was really funny to see the back and forth in Abarbanel about duels. I thought that was very interesting.
Could they have been afraid of, they ran away because they thought if they were slaves, they'd be forcibly circumcised?
Who's they?
Beck Cheryl.
No, who's they?
It said they ran off.
You're talking about at the end of the chapter? No, they ran off because the Jews are running after them to kill them.
Because they didn't want to be slaves they'd be circumcised. Okay.
But Rabbi,
yeah.
Doesn't that contradict the concept of Goliath, the one who had the definition that Goliath was the middle of his brothers?
Yeah.
Because how could he be the middle of his brothers and we have all these other tall guys not coming out now and bashing the Jews after their brother gets killed, and there should be revenge and all of that.
Right. So the view that he's average, I don't think in really means to play that out through the story. I think it's hard to sustain that in the story.
Yeah.
But I have a different question that no one's asked yet, which is, you have this guy Goliath, right? Goliath. He's awfully tall and awfully strong and really well armored. Where has he been? This is war number 4 in Shmuel. Where has this guy been? Why are we only meeting him in chapter 17?
Maybe he was too young and he grew up.
He just came of age? I mean, how big is he for his age? He just graduated high school. Now he's eligible. Like, what?
Maybe he was conquered from another people.
He doesn't sound like it. And he says, I'm the Philistine. Sorry, Claudette, you were going to say?
I think that this whole description of his might is to show that when God is with an individual, even all that might doesn't matter. So I think David had God on his side.
And I think that's true, but it doesn't explain where this guy's been all along. I think you're right, and we're going to get to that. But where has he been? So, Benita, I unmuted you.
I'm saying he's a hired hand. Maybe he's a hired hand.
But he says, I am the Philistine.
Maybe he was.
Why do you open that way if you're not?
Maybe he was kept in hiding when they felt they really needed this. Up till now, they've been winning a lot. So maybe they pulled him out.
So you took your best weapon? It seems really hard. So I think it's important to understand a couple of things. We'll start on this now. We're not going to finish it today. But number one, what does Goliath represent in this story? I have two approaches for what he represents. Number one, the most obvious, is that he represents the Plishtim. He represents the Philistines as a whole. I am the Plishti. Right? Although, granted, Rashi and Radak also read Anochi HaPlishti as I'm just a simple Plishti, like I'm nobody big, I'm just a guy. But the Medrash picks up on this much more, and it's brought in Targum Yonatan. Take a look, please, at source number 8 first. I know. I skipped number 8 in my notes. That's funny. Okay. So first, let's do number 8, and then we'll do number 9. But number 8 is important. We talked about this idea of a duel and having representatives fight, and the possibility that this is meant to spare lives. So this passage comes from Shmuel Bet, chapter 2. After Shaul is dead, Avner, his general, says, I'm going to support Ishbosheth, Shaul's son. So you have David on the one hand as king, but you also have Ishbosheth claiming the throne. And there's a showdown between the forces of David, led by General Yoav, and the forces of Ishbosheth, led by General Avner. And take a look at source number 8. I'm just going to read the current translation here. I'm going to mute everybody again because I hear a phone somewhere. But take a look at source number 8. And Avner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Shaul, went out from Machanayim to Gibeon. And Yoav, the son of Tsruya, the servants of David, went out, and they met together by the pool of Gibeon, the two armies. And they sat down, the one on one side of the pool, the other on the other side of this pool. And Avner said to Yoav, let the young men now arise and play before us. And that's the word in the Hebrew, visachaku. They should play. It sounds like a game. And Yoav said, let them arise. Then there arose and went over by number 12 of Binyamin, belonging to Ishbosheth, son of Shaul, and 12 of the servants of David. And they caught every one his fellow by the head and thrust his sword in his fellow's sides. So they fell down together. And that place was called Chalkat HaTzurim, which is in Gibeon. There was a very sore battle that day. Avner was beaten and the men of Israel before the servants of David, and it leads to bloodshed. So in other words, what I'm trying to suggest is this idea of having champions fight as surrogates for the army may be what's going on there and maybe what's happening in our story. But take a look at source number 9, please, because this is the part that I wanted to show you about Goliath as a representative of the Plishtim, and it will answer the question of where he has been all along. Targum Yonasan, I'm going to read out my English translation to save time. I am Goliath. This is when he says, Anochi haplishti, I am the Philistine. Targum Yonatan, the Aramaic commentary to the text, has him say, I am Goliath, the Philistine of Gat, who killed the two sons of Eli, the Kohanim Chofni and Pinchas. And I captured the Ark of the Covenant of God, and I brought it to the house of Dagon, my idol. And it was there in the Philistine cities for 7 months. Also, in every Philistine battle, I went out at the head of the forces, and I was victorious in war. He's forgetting what happened in chapter 13. And I cast corpses like the dust of the earth. And until now, the Philistines did not approve me to be a general upon them. But you know what? I'm just a guy. But I led them in every war, and I am the one. Every nightmare the Jews have had since the beginning of the book of Shmuel has been at the hands of Goliath. He's not new. He's been involved all along, but he wasn't named until the battle with David, which is going to raise the question, which Susan perhaps was about to ask. Why not name him until now?
That was why. I was going to say it, but the other thing, it says in my commentary on the same thing you just read, that he goes on to say, you are a servant of Saul, whom you made king, although he never performed any heroic deeds, but they made him king because
we're getting there, but it's going to be next week. It'll be next week. So the Cheryl, sorry,
wasn't he from Moa?
We now have very little time, as in 1 minute, so you have to wait. The idea here, and what I want us to leave off with, is Goliath has come out all intimidating as intimidating can be. He's got the weapons. He's got the height. He makes this offer to the people. But it's not just that he's making an offer to the people. He embodies everything the Jews have undergone at the hands of the Plishtim, at the hands of the Philistines. So that's one way to look at him. However, next week, and I think Cheryl was actually leading toward this before I had to take over. What we're going to see next week is that there's a whole other layer to what Goliath represents. And it's not about being a Philistine at all. It's about a different piece of his identity, which we're going to come back to, his heritage and where he comes from. But I don't want to give it away. So I'm sorry, I said next week, but that's actually incorrect. We do not have class next week. It's too close to Rosh Hashanah. So we'll have next, the 24th, God willing, we will have a shiur, and then after that we'll take break for Sukkot. But there's no shiur next Thursday, shiur on the 24th, God willing. Everyone is invited to the pre-Slichos program, Motzai Shabbos, Saturday night. I think I emailed it to you, from 10 p.m. to 1:30.